Well, hello and welcome into the Cultural Coven. I'm your host, actress Nicola Roy, and as always, I'm delighted you're going to be joining me for some chats with Scotland's much-loved arts and cultural figures. And what a cracking and interesting guest I have for you today. None other than Irish-born, award-winning Scottish actress of screen and stage and only the second ever female president of the Creative Union Equity and daughter of the late, great actor, comedian and gentleman of Scottish show business, the legend Johnny Beattie. It is, of course, the simply wonderful Maureen Beattie OBE. Maureen's an actress I looked up to from a young age, having watched her on stage, and when I was allowed to stay up a wee bit later and watch it in Casualty on a Saturday night. I then first crossed paths with Maureen when I made my own Lyceum stage debut in John Byrne's adaptation of Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard, in which Maureen played the lead. And it was there that I was firsthand able to witness her incredible dedication to the craft. Here we talk about everything from wonderfully colourful theatrical tales to body image and rebuilding relationships with equity. I would also like to note that this weekend the Scottish theatrical community came together to celebrate the life of the late Madeleine Imrie. Madeleine was a brilliant theatre director and radio producer, a warm and talented lady who made a lifelong commitment to encouraging creatives to always achieve their best. There was a beautifully fitting ceremony, concert really, led by her lovely daughter, my friend Rosie Kelleher. Madeleine's contribution to Scottish arts and culture will never be forgotten. Well, that's enough chat from me. If you enjoy the conversation, please do remember to subscribe so you never miss an episode, and maybe leave a cheeky wee review too, if you fancy. Enjoy. The Cultural Coven is presented in association with the Stephen Dunn Theatre Fund and the Lyceum Theatre. So, hi Maureen, and welcome into the Cultural Coven. I am just delighted to be in your presence today. How are you?
I'm as delighted as you are to be in yours.
Oh, why, thank you. So today is a wee bit different because we are in the Lyceum Theatre. We are at the back of the Grand Circle, and this is actually my first in-person Cultural Coven recording because the last series had to be done remotely due to restrictions.
Of course, yes.
Yeah, so it's a wee occasion, and so naturally, I've had a wee word with the resident theatre ghost, Ellen Terry, asking her that she ensures we have no technical difficulties. Do you believe in theatre ghosts, Maureen? Have you maybe had any encounters at the Lyceum yourself?
I never have had an encounter in any theatre myself, but I have worked with people who are sensible folk. You know,
right.
Not folk you think, aye, that'll be right, which is too much of the old cannabis resin or whatever, you know. Who absolutely, and the first encounter I ever had was with someone who claimed regularly to see ghosts was the woman who was the resident designer at Perth Rep when I started in the business.
Really?
I was an acting ASM and she was the resident designer, and she used to do, as all designers do, all-nighters, you know, and she would be in the theatre on her own up in the wardrobe, which was above the gods.
Mm-hmm.
And she used to regularly talk about this Victorian lady who used to kind of float about and sit down and watch her, but she was so in costumes. So I have no problem believing that, but I personally have never had that experience.
Ah, okay, because I would say I have been a sceptic, but genuinely, and I don't know if I told you this, but when we first worked together and we were doing John Byrne's adaptation of Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard, I vividly remember I was standing at stage right, waiting to go on, and I was alone. I'd felt something cold pass me, and it wasn't John Keelty Breaking Wind, it definitely wasn't. I felt this really sort of cold presence, and I felt completely frozen. And since then, I've had a slight unease about being at stage right alone.
Ah, yeah, I would understand that, absolutely.
But then I kind of rationalise it and go, well, actually, when you think about it, it's a bit darker on that side, you know, the cue desk's at stage left,
yeah.
So maybe I was imagining it, but I've now become quite superstitious, and I'm sort of go, well, if I say I don't believe, then something's going to happen. So I say a little prayer to the theatre ghosts before I go on. Do you do any kind of rituals before you go on stage, Maureen?
No, because I've worked with people who literally can't function if they don't go through whatever it is that they've built up over their years.
Yes.
Or if they don't have the gonk that they always have with them, or the picture of their partner or their child or their dog, which I understand, but I just, so very early on, I worked with a few people like that, and I thought, I'm not going to let that happen to me, because I cannot bear the idea of standing in the wings going and just suddenly realising, oh my goodness, I haven't got whatever it is with me. So I don't have anything like that. But I understand the desire to have sort of talismans and a ritual. My dad, who I'm sure you'll talk about at some point, it's unavoidable that Johnny Beattie, famous, passed away last year, as you know. He washed his feet. Washed his feet before every performance. Well, no, I think if he had a matinee and an evening, he didn't wash them. He washed it before the matinee.
Yeah.
But that was the thing. And it was the, hold on just 1 second. I haven't washed my feet. And he would, and of course, the dressing rooms in those days, none of your fancy walk-in showers and all that stuff that you sometimes get. Mm. Although, as you and I know, Nicola's backstage conditions can be appalling still, but in the kind of more modernised theatres. And he would literally take off whatever socks and shoes, kilt socks and shoes, whatever it was, or his tights if he was doing Dame. And he would up with the leg, would go into a basin, and he would wash and dry his feet. For some reason, he'd done it early on in his career, and it became a little bit of a kind of a like, it was like, before I've washed my feet, I'm not ready for the show, and after I've washed my feet, I am.
I kind of like that ritual, actually. It's very hygienic, and I can imagine it sort of wakens you up a little bit before you go on stage. Yeah. So I once briefly worked with your lovely late father, the legend Johnny Beattie, when I did a wee stint on River City, and what a charming, lovely man. I will never forget his warmth. And I was sitting doing a scene with him in the tall ship, and we'd stopped filming for a second, and it was my first scene with him, and you know, I was straight out of drama school, a newbie, and we got talking, and I told him that I liked dancing. And so when we stopped filming, he said, "Come here, Dan, do you want a wee dance?" And I said, "What?" And we did a little waltz, and he was such a gentleman, but he knew that that kind of just relaxed me into the scene. Such a lovely man. Yeah. And so I am really, really sorry to hear of your dad's passing, Maureen. I know you were really close, and the few occasions after that I was in his company, it was apparent that he was teeming with pride when he saw you on stage. I can imagine it's been a difficult time for you.
It was a difficult time, obviously, for all the family. My mum passed away, amazingly, 28 years ago. Gosh, it's extraordinary. He was such a massive presence, and amazingly, he passed away in July last year, and we were all going, gosh, family were going, Dad's been gone a year, COVID, that strange double time that COVID gives us, which is that it's forever, but it's really quick as well.
Mm.
So it literally feels like he passed away a few months ago. And when we were arranging his funeral, you know, my father's Roman Catholic, lapsed, but he, you know, and, you know, the church where he and my mum got married, and where all my siblings were baptised, and, you know, Holy Communions were had and all that sort of thing, was St Peter's down in Partick. And it was so safe. I mean, St Peter's, I don't know whether you've ever been in it, it's a massive church.
Mm.
And, you know, we were literally 4 metres apart, each of us.
Yeah.
So there was no question of it being, you know, in any way dangerous, you know.
Do you think you'll have any sort of memorial service in the future that might allow?
Yes, that would definitely be the case. But, you know, as I was talking to Janice Forsyth about Ida Schuster, the fabulous Ida Schuster, you know, who died, what, 103? God, wasn't she amazing?
Incredible.
What a fabulous woman. Well, you know, and we're saying, got to have a memorial service for Ida. And I think there's so many people. So I think Dad's just going to have to join the queue, because we're all going to want to go to so many of them.
Of course. Please take me back to the beginning. So you were born in Ireland, I believe, because your dad was over there touring, is that right?
Yeah, so I was born in Bundoran in County Donegal, because very near the beginning of my father's career, so it was literally like about a year into his career, he was offered a second comic on the bill in a summer season in St Patrick's Hall in Bundoran. So, but what basically happened was, my mother was a model when my mum and dad married, and my dad had come out of the shipyards, but he was, you know, known for his, as so many people in the shipyards, known for his wit and gay badinage. And so he thought, and it very much with mum's, you know, support, he said, okay, I'm going to give it a go, because mum was earning really good money, and she was the star in those days.
Your mum was a very famous Scottish model, wasn't she?
Mannequin, as they were called then. Mannequin. Kitty Lamont was her name. Kitty Lamont, the mannequin, will be at such and such a store and will open it on Saturday afternoon. People just come there and get autographs. Nobody knew who Dad was. Anyway, so she got pregnant with me, and when she got to be about 6 months pregnant, which meant that it was obvious that she had had sex with somebody. You can think back in then the early 50s, that was not good. So she had to stop modelling. And she came over to join Dad for the last 3 months of her pregnancy. And so that's why I was born in Bundoran.
Wow.
Actually, it's a nice story about that. Because my mother knew that she was going to have to get back to work really quickly. And this was way, I mean, now we're all into birth pools and having babies at home and, you know, people having do it with acupuncture and all that sort of stuff. But back then it was like, what? And this very, very Irish midwife who'd brought thousands and thousands and thousands of Roman Catholic wains into the world, you know, you can imagine. And next one along here, please. Thank you very much.
Conveyor
pop
belt.
Just go there. Yeah, yeah. Pop it out. That's lovely. Next, you know, they were all having. So my mother was had got this book from America, which was about natural childbirth. And it was all about, it was mainly about how you kept your muscles in toned and how you kept your weight at a certain level, so you didn't put on too much weight, but neither did you lose weight, you know, all that sort of thing. And it was about really getting back to your full, you know, pre-pregnancy, whatever you wanted it to be. So, and of course, this midwife was like, sorry, what? No, trust me, I have brought thousands and thousands and thousands. I know what I'm doing. And mum went, well, I'm going to do this. Okay, okay. But when my mum was leaving with me when I was about 3 weeks old to come back to Glasgow, and of course, the whole family came over from Glasgow because it was the first grandchild.
Yeah.
The midwife said, I'd like you to give me that book. I really want to, I want to try and get my women to do that, because I think it's, I was, my mother was in 4.5 hours labour for me.
Four and a half hours.
Out I came.
And that's especially for a first baby, I believe that's very quick.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. She's made of very stern stuff, my mother. You know, good Irish peasant stock. I've just applied for my Irish passport so I can remain in Europe, which would be very nice.
Oh, lucky you.
So that'd be
great.
Very
envious. So ever since I've been a little girl, I've kind of been fascinated by what it would be like to grow up in a theatrical family, because my family were so not theatrical, very kind of normal. What was it like in the BT household?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing, because people used to always, I remember at school, people said that your dad tell jokes all the time. Well, of course he didn't, because that was his job.
Yeah.
So it really was a bit like, you know, I would be fascinated to go, gosh, your father's a plumber. That must be interesting. How does that work? You know, so it was just the norm. It was absolutely the norm. I remember my brother Mark, who's about 7 and a bit years younger than me. Apparently the mum and dad went up to some parent-teachers event, something like that, and the teachers was laughing a lot and said to my mum and dad, you know, they had to stand up and do a wee thing about what their parents did. And apparently Mark stood up and said, my dad goes into Glasgow town, into the city centre at night, and he dresses up as a woman. And he and they're all like that. Yes, that's possibly, perhaps a little context. Because, of course, Dad was, you know, at the Pavilion doing Dame, you know. So, I mean, it was. I look back on it and I realise, I mean, it was incredibly glamorous. I mean, it was incredibly glamorous. I mean, you know, my mother ran this, she was a model herself, but then ran this hugely, I mean, the most successful model agency in Glasgow.
Wow.
And, you know, this is back in the day when the Kelvin Hall Arena, which of course was the place where the Ideal Home exhibition happened every year, and where the fair happened, and where the boat show and all, I mean, car shows, all these, and they all had a fashion show attached to them.
Right.
And it was, I mean, and these girls were like, they were like flamingos. They were like flamingos wandering about with their makeup and their hair and all up. And of course, don't forget, I mean, I was born in 1953 and, you know, the 60s. So I was in my sort of, you know, I was 10 in 1963. So, you know, when I was in my early teens living at that, the 60s happened.
Was your house kind of full of fascinating people? And
well, I mean, I think so. But I mean, I think probably people are fascinating generally. It's just that maybe they looked a bit more, you know, I mean, I remember things like, you know, at one point when I was still at school in high school, Jimmy Logan was married to Gina Frattini, the fashion designer.
Yes.
I mean, she was in the house wandering about in one of her beautiful dresses. Mum and Dad had a dinner party and came in to talk to me. And I was like, "That, do you know who you are?" You know, I suppose so. Being around, I think one of the things that's we are so lucky, Nicola, you know, is that everyone has a creative imagination.
Mm.
But some people are lucky enough to be able to use it when we get a chance in our business, and you know, who knows, as we know that, you know, with COVID and everything, but to use it to earn a living. You know, happy the man who lives by his hobby, which is something that, you know, in the play Pygmalion by George Bernard Shaw, yes, is, you know, one of the characters says that. And that's right, you know, to do something that you absolutely love for a living and use your creative imagination and your, you know, it is fantastic. And so I suppose those were the people that I was sort of surrounded by. And also the whole time when I was, you know, at school and everything like that, I wanted to be an actress from the age of 10. So I was always, you know, elocution classes, you know, Jeanne Gourley. Do you remember Jeanne Gourley at all?
Did she ring a bell? No.
Well, there was this woman called Jeanne Gourley, who was actually Jeanne Gourley, as she was a butcher's daughter through Partick. But she had gone to RADA, and she'd obviously not managed to make it as an actress. She used to talk about Larry and Viv, you know, Laurence Olivier and Viv.
Yes.
And but she was a brilliant teacher, really brilliant. And, you know, if you were aspirational at all and you wanted better things for your weans, you sent them to Jeanne Gourley. There were no boys, all girls. And you went to Jeanne, and she taught you how to speak.
And was this like once a week or something?
Yeah, that was once a week, and you paid for it. And then, but what I actually always remember one of Jeanne Gourley's sound sort of poems that you had to learn a certain sound.
Please give us it.
And I will. And I do remember I had a friend called Jeannie McHardy, and we literally would go up to the door and we would press the doorbell. And while we were waiting for Jeanne Gourley to open the door for this class, we'd be talking like that to each other. Oh, Albus, I had a terrible time like that. And she would open the door and we'd go, good evening, Scotty. You know, it was literally like, she thought we were talking like that all the time. This was the oi sound.
Right.
A woman, like a well-oiled car, should noiseless be and never jar. Her poise suggests a smooth Rolls Royce, assured in movement, manners and voice. I mean, not only is that hysterical just because of what it is, but actually that was what women were. We were supposed to be like that. We were supposed to be assured in movement, manners and voice. Aye, that'll be right.
Walking around Glasgow speaking like
exactly
this.
Well, old car. The other one was, father has a car in the garage. And one of the girls in the thing went, we don't have a car or a garage. it was just brilliant.
Were your parents happy that you were to follow in your dad's footsteps, knowing kind of the pitfalls of the business, or did they ever try and steer you in a different direction?
That is a really good question for me, because when I was filling in my application form for the College of Drama, the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Dramatic Art, as it was, just could call it College of Drama, it had three courses. One was the acting course, one was the teaching course, and one was the stage management course. That was all the three. So I knew I didn't want to be a stage manager. And I was like, oh, I didn't realise I had a teaching course. It never dawned on me. So what should I do? So I said to Mum and Dad, and Dad said, well, look, you know, they were both sitting together. He said, look, you should do the teaching course, he said, because then you've got something to fall back on, you know, because this business is, you know, perilous, blah, 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 blah. And Mum said, that's great. So let me get this right. You're going to go and train for 3 years to do a job that you don't actually want to end up doing? And I went, tick on the acting one. And I remember when we were doing our, you know, our showcase at the end, I was like, what will I do? And it was so difficult to pick those pieces and oh my God. And Mum said, okay, does anybody ever do a song? And I went, no, nobody ever sings. Nobody ever sings. She went, sing a song. I went, well, oh, she said, yeah, because the first thing that those people are going to do when they come out of there, the judges, and they sit down, is they're going to write down the people they remember. That's the first thing that will happen. And I remember bumping into, or meeting up with Joan Knight, who gave me my first job out of drama school, acting ASM at Perth. Fabulous start, fabulous, yeah. Legend of a woman.
Yes.
And I met up with her for lunch, and she was down in London a few years later, interviewing people for the rep season, and she said to me, if one more young woman comes in here and takes all of their clothes off and does, because there was that play set in the women's bathhouse at the time, Steaming.
Oh, okay.
And of course they were all doing that, because so each of them thought, I know what I'll do, she'll remember me because I take all my clothes. And she was literally like, please don't take your clothes off and do Steaming, because she'd seen 14 people do it. So it's that funny thing of getting just something that just lifts you out of the,
yes,
that reminds them of you, might be something you say to them or something you wear. Maybe you're wearing something, a bright red, something, whatever it might be. I really do think that's a Yeah,
I think that's a really good piece of advice, because I think either when you're auditioning for drama school or when you're doing your showcase, there's always a kind of popular piece that everyone wants to do, and they've seen it so many times.
Yeah.
You can be brilliant, but it's very hard to make it different, to stand out when they've seen 25 versions of it, for example. Because your mum sounds such a savvy lady.
Yeah, she was really, really bright, as well as being very beautiful. And there's some fabulous stories about her beginning. Basically, my mother was... the third of three illegitimate children, all by different men, to this her mother, who was very, very attractive, very beautiful, but not very bright, let's put it that way. And this wasn't unknown back in those days. My mother was born in 1930. Anyway, she ended up, her mother died when my mother was 2.5. She ended up being sort of, you know, with the best will in the world, she was passed about from pillar to post. Nobody quite knew how to look after her, adoption and all that sort of thing. And anyway, eventually, she was unofficially adopted by this childless couple. And he was dead by the time I was born, but she, I thought, was my grandmother until ages later. It was, you know, actually, she wasn't related.
Yes.
My mother got to the age of 15. I think she was 15 on a Friday. Stopped work, went straight to work. Stopped school, went straight to work on the Monday. And at that point, Jint, who was my grandmother person, and her sister, who I called Auntie Chrissy, who was fabulous, she was living with the two of them. So it was the three women in the house. And so my mother went to this thing, and she answered an advert in the paper, which was, tall girl wanted to try on coats, must be numerate.
What an advert.
Fabulous. So that was in the days when the Queen Street in Glasgow was the hub of the rag trade. Right. So, and this was a coat manufacturer. Mm-hmm. So the idea was that they wanted a girl, and my mother was absolutely standard size. She's 5'6" and a standard size 12 to wear what they call the toile, which is when they're making up the designs, they make it up in a calico and everything like that, said all right before they use the material. So until before the model, the proper model, came in and modelled it up and down in the showroom and everything like that for the collections coming in, they wanted somebody to be able to do that. But that wasn't a full job. So what they did was they said, well, that person can also do things in the accounting department, run around, get coffees, all that sort of thing. So that's what the job was. So my mother was there for however long, it got to 17, 18, something like that. And she was always, and then she would dress the models.
Right.
And they come in. And back in those days, of course, there were all this lady this and baroness that and the right honourable this and that, because it was like something you did for a hobby and got a little pin money for, and then you got married to somebody incredibly rich and didn't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so this woman said to my mother, she said, Catherine, you could model. And mum went, what? I mean, it was like unheard of, you know. Yeah. She said, no, you're lovely, lovely looking woman, great, tall, carry yourself well, blah, blah, blah. Mum said, oh, right, oh, she said, I could train you if you like. And mum went, oh, that would be amazing. She said, yeah, it's only 13 guineas. Some of them was like that. Well, that's never going to happen. My mother was earning like, you know, £1 and 5 shillings or something like that then. So she thought, well, that's not going to happen. But anyway, never mind. Oh, she was full of it. So she got back home to Jint and Chrissy and said, told them the story, the excitement. Oh my God, amazing. Me a model. Aye, that'll be right. So away she goes into work, comes back from her work the next day, and on her bed was £15.
Oh.
15 £1 notes. And my wee auntie Chrissy had taken out her life savings, put them on the bed and said, that's for you. And my mother was like, what? She said, that's for you. She said, it's not a gift. She said, you'll give me that back 100-fold. I know you're going to go places. That's for you to do that. So my mother was able to take that money in, give it to that woman, got the training, and then, you know, became this incredibly famous person who was earning a lot of money running her own business.
What a beautiful story.
Isn't it fab?
Because had maybe her aunt not done that, then who knows?
Who knows what would have happened? Absolutely.
So, and do you think being around all these clothes and models, did that ignite a passion in you for costumes at all? Or
I think it kind of had the opposite effect, really.
Oh, really?
Weirdly, you know, that thing of, I actually went through a phase, to be completely honest, almost phobic about clothes, buying clothes.
Oh, morning.
I couldn't, you know. And then, do you remember back in the 70s? All these changing rooms became communal.
Oh,
it was all that ghastly stuff. And I just so, there was nothing wrong with me, but I was just so, not that there would be anything wrong with anybody, that was the wrong thing to say. You know, I just got incredibly self-conscious. I felt that everybody was looking at me going, my God, what's that big plain lump of a lassie? So I think that there was that side of it. It was fabulous, but it was also quite sort of I don't know what's the word I'm looking for.
Did it make you self-aware and self-critical?
Yeah, very self-critical. That's exactly the word I'm looking for.
Slightly some sort of like body dysmorphic disorder where you can't see how other
people
see you.
Yes, absolutely. That's exactly what it is. I think that, and I listen to and watch young women, but also young men nowadays, because it's increasingly something that's, you know, it was very much when I was growing up, you know, to do with what women looked like. And I definitely had that. I had an eating disorder. It was compulsive eating. I was never bulimic. I'm really thrilled to say that wasn't. I was just lucky. I never was. I was never anorexic, but I had a terrible problem with food. Compulsive eating, and then, you know, starving myself to try and I had this idea that I was a huge, great round ball. I was never. I mean, you're sitting in front of me now. I'm about, I don't know what I'm at. 10 stone 8, 10 stone
You're
9,
tiny, yeah.
I was literally about half a stone heavier than I am at the moment. And I thought I was like a, you know, so it's it, all that stuff that we know. But the other, you know, here I am, it's Margie Proops, if anybody remembers Margie Proops. She was an agony aunt back in the day, Women's Own. But the book that changed my life
is
a book called Fat is a Feminist Issue. And it's by a woman called Susie Orbach, who is an American psychologist. And it is about the fact that she looked at the fact that all these slimming clubs and slimming magazines and all that sort of thing. And she did a bit of research and she realized, not all, in every case, I know that it works really brilliantly for some people, but often the women who were in those images of, you know, you see a woman standing in one leg of the trousers she used to wear,
yes,
and all that,
yeah,
sort of,
yeah,
those kind of things, would go back to the weight they had been and more. So her question was, what are these women getting out of that? Why are these women doing that? They must be getting something out of having that weight on them, that fat, that whatever you want to call it, that body shape. So she started, and it was all about the fact that fat is a feminist issue. People put on weight in order to protect themselves. Sometimes you're just greedy, sometimes you just eat a wee bit too much and then you stop and you're fine. But an awful lot of us, that was my thing, was, and it was really interesting to look at that, and it changed my life. I had such terrible time around food and really, really worried, panicky if I didn't know I could get to food.
Right.
And I couldn't just, I ate all day long. And after that, I did the exercises she said in the book, some of which made me go, oh, all right, then we'll give that a go, you know. Mm-hmm. And I haven't had a problem with food since. Well, I mean, that was nearly 40 years ago.
Well, Maureen, I'm sorry I didn't realise that you had been through that. Whilst we're sharing, Maureen, I'm going to tell you, you actually had a positive effect on me. I think maybe without realising, when we were doing Dark Road, not pretending to be to the same extent that you were talking about there, but I'm quite bad for stress eating, and you know, you just go through stages of just not really liking how you look.
Yeah.
And I remember one of the characters I was playing, she was the victim of one of the murders, and there was to be a picture taken of her. And do you remember there was the images of the girls were blown up on a screen on stage? And I was like, oh my God, look, I just couldn't look at it. I don't know if you just said something, you came up and you held my hand, it looks great. And I was like, oh, I was dying inside, but you just sort of reassured me a little bit. But isn't it funny? Because I think people assume, you know, actors, we put ourselves up on that stage, and it's not particularly useful to not have great body image when you're putting yourself
absolutely
out in the public eye. But it sounds like you had a particularly bad time, and I think that sounds like a book that a lot of people should check out.
Definitely, and it's upgraded every so often, you know, to add, and I think increasingly it's much more inclusive of men as well,
right?
You
yeah,
know? And I think also that thing, you know, for people in our industry, and particularly for people who are well known, you know, that as you say, that instant thing of, oh, you are thinking, aren't you? You're the person I think you are. Oh, ah, can I get a selfie? Can I get a selfie? And it's already, they're behind you, they're beside you, and they're taking that picture. Now, it might be the day after your father passed away. You might not have taken your makeup off before you went to your bed because you were grieving or whatever it might be, you know, who knows? And then if you're not, you know, the vast majority of people are just fantastic. But
of course,
if you're not, you know, instantly amenable to all that, it's like, oh, get you. Who do you think you are? Think you're great, don't you? You're like that. Well, no, actually, but you're not taking on board how I might feel. You know, it's like that ever you have to be ever present and ever performing. Yes. That famous thing that Marilyn Monroe used to say, she would say, is it time to put on Marilyn? Because she would walk about and she wouldn't, she'd just be like having a, you know, whatever. And then she would suddenly go, well, and then we'd go, oh yeah, time to put on Marilyn. And suddenly this transformation would happen when she suddenly became connected. Fascinating.
I was going to ask you, I suppose there would be an expectation that your dad might have done an autobiography, but he didn't, did he?
I cannot tell you the number of times I have tried to get him to do that. Friends have tried to get him to do that. Friends who are journalists, Andy Dugan, who used to be the showbiz editor of the Evening Times, he offered to ghostwrite it.
Oh, right.
So that basically Dad would just speak into a tape recorder and Andy would put it together like that. There was something about it that Dad just, I don't know, it wasn't like a, I never want to do that, but, and eventually one day he just said, that's far too much of hard work. Far too much of hard work, I'm not going to do that. What he does have, we have sound recordings of the one-man shows that he used to do, which were basically, they never had really much structure. I did find when we were going through Dad's, the stuff that Dad had, a man who never left, threw anything out. I cannot even begin to tell you what it was like. Catalogues for plums, bri nylon, you know, cushion covers and, you know, soft furnishings from 1983. You never know when that might come in useful.
Oh, goodness. Well, yes.
Never know, Nicola. So things like that. And you know, one purple shoelace, because you never know when you might need a purple shoelace. I'm a bit of a hoarder myself, but my goodness, he could have hoarded for the Olympics on behalf of the UK. Oh, it's extraordinary. But loads of fantastic stuff. And in actual fact, one of the great things was that my friend John Carnegie, the Scottish director, he told me about the archive at Glasgow University. There are several different archives, and I didn't know that Glasgow University had one, and they've got a Scottish theatre archive. So anyway, so we took down two full carloads of stuff, and I think the woman who came to the door was a bit, oh, that's like a whole other archive on its own, which was wonderful. So there was loads and loads of fabulous stuff, but also things, so rough outlines that he would do of what he was going to talk about. But the one-man shows that he did were basically him talking about his career.
Right.
So we've got them. So maybe one day, if I've got enough time, maybe I'll collate them and maybe put them into some kind of order and try and tell the story of my dad's career a wee bit in his background, you know.
Wonderful. I mean, it's the sort of thing I could even imagine some sort of documentary on television.
Well, yeah. I mean, they have done, also that's the other thing that's out there, you know, they did one called Golden Boy for his, would that be his 50th anniversary of being in the business, you know, and all that sort of stuff. I mean, one of the things that we did, Nicola, we did my dad's 60th anniversary of being in the business, we put on a show at the Citizens Theatre in Glasgow. Dominic Hill was really helpful, yeah. And as were all the staff. They were absolutely brilliant for two charities. My dad's two favourite charities, one of which is the Showbiz Benevolent Fund in Scotland here, yes. And the other of which is the hospice out at Clyde Bank, St Margaret's Hospice, which is where my dad ended his days. Wonderful place. I'm just extraordinary. But so we did that, and what we did was we put together what I was absolutely without question the last of the variety shows that you will ever see. It's certainly in Scotland, and I got all the old pals together, and so that was fantastic to do, because, you know, where do you see variety now? You just don't really. You can in clubs, in pubs, but it tends to be maybe one or two acts. It's not that thing of the big opening number with the dancers and the singers and the da-da-da, and then the comedian comes on and does a warm-up, and then somebody comes on with a, you know, a fiddle or an accordion, and then somebody does a sketch, and then there's a singer, and then there's a double act, and then just, you know, it just doesn't exist anymore.
Kind of makes me sad that I never really got to see any of that, because it feels such a part of Scottish theatrical history.
Definitely, yeah. And I mean, my God, talk about Bring the House Down, fabulous. Because it was all connected with Dad and the things that Dad liked and the things that mattered to him. You know, it just fabulous. You know, Fiona Kennedy was there, wonderful, singing Sweet Rossy Bay, that, you know, Dad loved Rossy so much. And, you know, Callum Kennedy, her father had been such a, you know, it was just, it was wonderful. And anyway, they filmed it for a documentary and had three locked off cameras. And my very dear friend, Christopher Rowlands, who at that point had just retired from being an editor at the BBC, has a home editing suite, which is broadcast quality. So he, as a gift to me and my dad, cut them all together. So we've got a record of all these things.
Oh,
so it's really, I'll get one to you.
Please,
I have to make some more copies though.
To see that, Maureen. Thank
of
you.
Course.
I really, really would. So Maureen, you were awarded an OBE for services to entertainment in 2019, which I believe is a higher accolade than an MBE. So did you trump your dad then? And was he all right with that?
That was very funny actually, because you know, you're not allowed to tell anybody until it's actually been announced.
Yeah.
So I went up to see Dad whenever it was. It was in the New Year's Honours list. I got mine, and I went up to Dad and I thought, oh, tell Dad, that'll really cheer him up. And I said, Dad, I've got something to tell you. Oh, yes. I said, I'm going to be given an OBE. Oh, darling, that's fantastic. He was very, very pleased. Thrilled. Then there was a silence and he said, an OBE. I said, yes, that's correct. He said, I've got an MBE. I said, yes. He said, and an OBE is better than an MBE. I said, yes, that's correct. And there was a moment when he was quite discombobulated by the whole thing.
Oh,
and then
joy.
It was, and then he rallied. And he went, oh, well, that's interesting. I said, suck it up.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
So we know in our industry there's sort of OBEs and MBEs can be a kind of conflicting subject.
Yeah.
Was it something you had to consider at all? Or
No, I didn't. I didn't. What I had done is I'd thought about it before. Just in terms of like, oh, I wonder if I was ever offered anything, how would I feel about it? So I suppose I had kind of thought about it before, and a bit like you think of, you know, we all think of what would your Desert Island Discs be?
Or your Oscar speech.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you think, yeah, that'll be right. But do you know what I mean? Or if I win 10 million quid in the lottery, what would I spend it on?
Yeah,
it's one of those things. But no, I didn't really, because my view is, and I know that there's this big movement, I think, which is growing in energy, which is to rename them and take the word empire out of there. And I can't remember what there's various suggestions as to what that would be, because you'd want to keep the E,
yes,
maybe call it endeavor or something like
okay.
that, which I understand. And of course, I don't want anything to do with empires of any description.
Yeah.
We now realize particularly how dreadful they are always. But for me, it's what we've got. It's what we've got to honour people. And it's weaponizable. It really, really is. Being able to say, like with the equity thing, you know,
yes,
that the president of equity would like to do whatever, you know, come and talk to Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so, whatever. And then be able to say, oh, and they're a bit more ambitious, OBE. Oh, it really, and I imagine if you're a dame or a knight, presumably even more
that's
so.
That's interesting.
So
yeah.
I really do think that that's true. And I think, and the other thing is, I've been to the palace twice now, once when my dad got his MBE, mm-hmm, which not as good as an OBE. and also obviously when I went get my own. And it gets a lot of bad press with, you know, that, oh yeah, captains of industry that have given the whatever parties in power X amount of money or whatever, if somebody's rubbed somebody's back. And that may well be true. But you are surrounded by people who have done the most extraordinary things.
Yes.
The most extraordinary things. I mean, yeah, people who, children coming and picking up awards for their parents who have passed away, you know, posthumously, done the most fantastic work at the end of their lives. When my dad picked his up, I don't know whether you remember, I can't remember how long ago it was, there was a particular young soldier who was in a tank who literally went, I am just going to walk into the situation and I am going to be dead at the end of it. There was no question that he would lose his life, but he was going to save his comrades. And as luck would have, the whole series of it, and he did save his comrades and he survived. And you just go, there is no greater, there is no higher thing that you could do for your fellow man than you lay down your life, your friend, you know. And you're in this, just these people who have just gone that. And actually, I mean, I was like, I'm going to take it, thanks very much, I'm going to. But I was actually sitting there thinking, all these people have done all these. And I also look at, you know, when I see things in the press of so-and-so, so-and-so OBE, and I go, gosh, they got an OBE. I got one as well. That's ridiculous, you know.
But I've observed your incredible work ethic firsthand, Maureen. Both times I've worked with you, you set up a desk in the rehearsal room and you usually have your lunch at the desk in the rehearsal room and you're working away. Is it just absolute dedication or is that part of your process?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I've never thought of it as something, as you know, that I do deliberately, but you're absolutely right. I would always go into a room and I would always go, that's a wee thing, nobody else is wanting that wee table there or that wee thing, I'll just put that there, get working my computer, sitting that. Yeah, yes, I do. You're absolutely right. So it's not, it's about in the chaos that is a rehearsal room. And it is chaotic, isn't it? Mm. I mean, even if it's a really, really well-run rehearsal room, it's not to do with that. It's to do with so many things going on, so many people, so many bits, props. And increasingly, as you're in the rehearsal and the weeks go by, you know, the more and more stuff appears.
Yeah.
And it's, I think it's about having a wee space to call your own where you're kind of, you can go to that's inviolate or something, do you know?
Right,
yeah, I've never thought, actually, it's really interesting you asked me that because I've never thought about it, but I do. You're absolutely right.
The Cultural Coven is delighted to have musical support from singer-songwriter, musician, member of the Red Hot Chili Pipers, and very importantly, a fifer, Cameron Barnes. This song, Coming Home, and the rest of Cameron's music is available on all the main streaming platforms. So go on, download it and have a wee dance about your kitchen. Thanks, Cameron, for letting us use this tune.
What we do is important.
Yeah.
What we do is absolutely vital. You know, the famous quote from Churchill, which was, you know, what are we fighting wars for if it's not for the arts? What's the point of it?
Yeah.
What is the point? Tell me what the reason is. And because they are what fills our heart with joy, they are, we can make people think about things in a way. That's why the governments don't like us, particularly Tories. Oh. Right-wing government, should I say, more just, you know, because there's some very good conservatives, we know that, but, you know, right-wing governments hate the arts because we get people thinking about them in a completely different way. The financial support for the arts in the UK is absolutely shocking. We bring in, you know, the arts bring in 111 point something billion quid a year into the UK, pre-pandemic, into the UK economy. We bring in more than farming, we bring in more than fishing, we bring in more than Premier League football, we bring in more than IT. I mean, this is just, this is so important on every level, but they don't like us. And the latest cuts, this is my equity hat on now, you can imagine, but the latest cuts into 50% cuts in arts educations in schools, the EBAC, the European Baccalaureate, which is the group of subjects which the government decide, I think it's on a yearly basis, or maybe slightly longer than that, which is, these are the subjects that need to be taught in school, we need kids to know about these going forward. There are no arts subjects in it at all.
Really?
No arts subject. That's been the case for a number of years, all of that stuff. Our Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, went to Eton. Eton has a fully equipped theatre. It has a Prosarch auditorium and a studio theatre, and it's got four of a staff at the last count.
So he should know the importance of the arts. And this is the thing that I have become so angry about during this pandemic. And I know, Maureen, that you have been incredible at lobbying the government during this time. The Tories have been... had such a dismissive attitude towards the arts, like, oh, they'll get on with it, they'll find a way, because that is what we do.
Yeah.
But we are in a time where our industry has been completely shut. People feel demoralised. We've been having to apply to charities to survive. They continually undermine our profession. But ironically, often these are the people that can afford to go and buy the expensive tickets. They are, you know, make up a high proportion of our audiences.
Yeah. My theory is that they absolutely know the importance of the arts. They absolutely know it. but they want to keep it to themselves because they know what an advantage it is. You go to Eton, you go to the thing, you go to the debating society, you learn an instrument, you go to your drama classes and everything like that. You know, the number of when the EBAC, the latest round of the EBAC was announced, loads of people who were CEOs of companies, high, doctors and surgeons at the highest level, running departments, you know, the top consultants, the big teaching hospitals, so many of them came forward and said, listen, I'm very good at what I do. I'm very good at my brain surgery or my whatever. But I was the shyest kid in the school. I couldn't. And then I went to drama classes and my goodness me, I blossomed. It made me able to work as part of a team. So you don't have to go into our industry.
There's so many transferable skills, isn't there?
So many.
And life skills.
Life skills, absolutely.
It's just so obsessing. But yes, Maureen, you are the president of Equity. I believe only the second female.
The second ever, yeah.
It's incredible. I have always grown up with a sense of the importance of trade unionism. Yeah. And when I've worked with you, you have always been very passionate in encouraging members of the company to ensure they're up to date with their subs. Maureen, it's no secret that there's been issues with Equity and its Scottish members of late. I am not the best placed person to talk about this, but because I know the strength of feeling in Scotland is quite strong and people are upset and hurt. And some have walked off Equity councils and quit their membership. I know that the Scottish Equity representative, Lauren Boswell, was made redundant in a time that we felt we needed representation more than ever. There's now talk of Scottish artists setting up their own union, and I just wondered what you thought about that, and do you have confidence that Paul Fleming's leadership could, I don't know, win back Scottish members?
I've got a few things to say. So one is, and this is absolutely true, this is not just blah, blah.
Sure.
It is really heartbreaking when anybody leaves this union. I would always say stay and fight. Stay and fight. Stay and tell us why you're upset and come and talk to us about it. The overall thing that happened in Scotland is, you know, with every new leader, there comes a... the leader has a chance to do things differently, to look at the world that they've inherited, be that a company and a union, whatever, and decide what needs to occur. It is a fact that Scotland has still, with its two staff members, got more staff representation than any, apart from London, of course, because that's where the hub is, because that's where 65%, 70% of our members are, but that's... So overstaffed and has been overstaffed for decades. The company, the union at the time was, I know a lot of people don't believe this, but this is the truth. I am stating the truth now. Okay. We were at a point financially where we might have gone under. Big changes needed to be made, and the biggest change that we could make was to reduce the number of staff. There were a lot of different changes made, and one of the biggest change, without question, was reducing the staffing in Scotland to two down from three. This is Paul's overarching way forward. What he wants is, he wants there to be, I speak for him, I think he would agree with what I'm saying, he wants there to be a feeling that the opposite of what some people think it's about, which is taking the power down to London even more. Yeah. He wants it to be much more of a joined up union, so that the people in Scotland feel much more in touch with the head office in London. But it caused, because of the enormous affection that Lauren is still held in, and the work that people in Scotland felt and feel that he did for them, and how he'd got their backs, and that became understandably an extraordinarily personal heartbreak for people.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I have personally benefited from Lauren's help in the past. I think it's an interesting approach to try and connect us down more with London. I imagine that you have felt conflicted about it. You know, Lauren was a big part of the Scottish cultural landscape.
Yeah.
And it did feel to some that there was an enforcement that Scotland is merely a region, which we know it's not, and it has a very vibrant community.
Yeah.
I just hope that we can work that we can, you know, we can all work this out, hopefully.
Well, I think one thing that is true, I'm very, very aware of the fact that there's a lot of work to be done to try and, you know,
win
people back and heal the wounds as best we can and really listen to people and try and make things, you know, make things better. It's incredibly important. And I think Paul knows that as well.
I think the thing as well is that a compulsory redundancy just felt at juxtaposition with what a trade union should stand for.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm glad. Well, a couple of years ago, Maureen, I know that you personally led investigations into sexual harassment and bullying in our industry not long after the Harvey Weinstein cases came to light. So thank you for that. I imagine, though, that it must have been an emotionally demanding thing to do. What do you think, going forward, we need to do to ensure safety in our rehearsal rooms or on set? How can we change mindsets?
Well, this is so of the essence, Nicola. I mean, funny enough, it was just after I was voted in as president for my second term of 2 years. You serve for 2 years. And I said, we need to reboot the Safe Spaces campaign because it did a lot of good. And, you know, I know people have said, you know, it really made a difference and all that sort of thing. But we always knew that the slime bags were going to crawl out from under their stones eventually. And some of them never, ever went under. I mean, they just ignored us and carried on behaving atrociously. And of course, as you know yourself, in Scotland, there's been a couple of things, you know, just dreadful stuff. And your man, Noel Clark, down in down south in England, you know, and that's just the tip of an iceberg that exists. So we've got to really look at it again, and we've got to. The one thing that we are doing, which is really important, is it's got to be embedded in our terms and conditions in our contracts that they have to look after their workers from the point of view of health and safety, and part of that has to be making sure that people are not bullied and harassed. You know, I mean, funnily enough, I had a conversation the other day with a young intimacy director, and a lot of the old school don't like intimacy direction because they just like to get down and dirty with the artists and just say. And so, you know what it's like, Nicola, never met the person before, so all the other stuff is all worked on, it's all, you know, done properly, and we'll rehearse it, and who's going where. You have a fight scene, you'd never do a fight scene without rehearsing it. Then you get a situation where two people are lying around in a bed naked together pretending to have sex, and nobody rehearses it. People go, yeah, just do that sex thing, and you're like, what? Anyway, so intimacy direction is absolutely fantastic. It's so great.
Yes.
And what's that? Anyway, I talked to this young intimacy director, and it was a woman director, and she said to me, the young intimacy director, she said, the woman director really didn't want me on the set. She really found it very difficult, kept elbowing me out of the way and everything like that. And then she eventually, when she realised she just had to pay attention to me, because the actors loved it, of course, they were like, oh, couldn't wait, you know, give it to me, like, you know, people, you know, in the desert with no water.
Yeah.
And she said, yes, okay, and over to you, intimate director, before I put you back in the corner again.
Oh, come on. I mean,
you're literally like, excuse me? So I think, so it's got to be embedded in the terms and conditions, absolutely. And they have got, one of the great things that's happened is, it's awful what happened, discovering that man, Noel Cart, was behaving like that. But that company that were making that big series that he was the lead in, they had to pull that final episode and never show it. That will have cost them a fortune. And that has made people sit up and go, whoa, hold on a minute. We can't have that happening. We cannot have somebody behaving like, it's going to cost us too much money, because it's all about the shareholders, it's all about the money, it's all about the moolah. So that's a silver lining in a terrible cloud. So is that... The other thing I think, and I touched on it there, that I think is really important, is trying to get together people like myself, and there is a movement in equity where we're putting it together, a sort of menteeship for specifically women, for younger women, but also for guys as well, and people who define themselves differently, to have, so people are in a room. I mean, I would like to take it further, and I'd like to actually have a thing where you go, I am part of, let's call them archangels. I know there was a thing in a charity in America like that. But, you know, we actually walk into a rehearsal room the first day and you go, hi, everybody. Can I just say before we begin, my name is Maureen Beattie and I'm one of the archangels. This is my badge. So if anybody's got anything happening or if I see anything at all, I'm the one that's responsible. I will speak about it.
I think that'd be brilliant because actually I know that there is a fear that if you speak out, you could be penalised or they're troublesome. Them actually. And so if we normalise having someone that is a representative, somebody that everyone feels they can trust, I think that'd be a wonderful thing because, you know, most of the time we have a wonderful time in our job and I would never want a rehearsal room to become so clinical that you cannot create art because that just wouldn't work. But you have to feel safe, you have to feel respected, and these behaviours that have been sometimes probably not consciously even sort of filtered into rehearsal rooms, they can't exist anymore. They just can't.
Absolutely. Yeah. The way that people speak to each other, everything from that to, you know, the absolute worst that that can become, it's got to be, we've got to change the culture so that that is so shocking when it happens. So shocking. I mean, that was one of the things that I found really interesting when I was setting up the Safe Spaces campaign with the then General Secretary Christine Payne, and my goodness me, it was all consuming at the time, which was great. Everybody came to talk to us and putting things together. But it made me think again about the way that I had been treated when I was at drama school and in my early days in the theatre, and the way that not everybody, as you said, most people are fantastic. And I was just completely shocked by the things that were said to me, the things that were done. I remember being uncomfortable, but I never thought, that's wrong, don't do that to me. Isn't it?
I agree. I found myself reassessing my past in the business and going, oh gosh, I've been really guilty of letting things go because you want to be liked and you want to be creative, you want to have a laugh.
Yeah.
But actually, you know, at the time I've gone, probably really shouldn't say that to me, or I've definitely had moments where I look back and I've been bullied and then the person's apologised but said, I'm sorry I did that, it's just I thought you were just a daft wee lassie. And I said, even if you thought I was a so-called daft wee lassie, what gives you the right to bully me?
Exactly. If you'd said to that person, excuse me, so you thought I was a daft wee lassie, you thought you were all right to bully me, you would have got, oh, catch a grip, relax, what's your problem? We're in the theatre, we all behave differently from other people. Sorry, why do we have to behave differently from other people? We just have the same respect for one another as anybody has.
Absolutely.
So it's all that, isn't it? It's such a massive culture change.
Absolutely,
but really
and there has to be, like you say, repercussions. People have to know that there are repercussions for that sort of behaviour.
Yeah.
Monique, I'm going to move on to our creative challenge. So you are an award-winning actress who's performed in all the finest theatrical houses in the land. But we know that there is a cardinal rule in theatre to try to not be the company C-U-N-T. But some of us, like myself, are usually just happy just to get our lines out in the right order.
Yes, exactly.
But Maureen, please give me Maureen Beattie's 5 top doing the acting tips. What would they be?
Okay. First of all, may I say that of course, as you will know, Nicola, there's the add-on to that thing about the C-U-N-T, which is, if you don't know who it is, it's probably you.
Yes. There's always the fear of
that. There's always the fear of it being you. Okay. Hamlet, canny quack Shakespeare. The readiness is all. Just do your prep. Do your prep. Yep. Learn your lines.
Yep.
Do any research you need to do. Maybe find out a wee bit about the way the company works. Maybe something about your now with the internet, about the people you're going to be working with. Do your prep. Readiness is all. Don't be afraid. We in the theatre, that's very posh. We in the theatre. But we in the theatre, we are showing, we are putting on a live entertainment for people. What you see on that stage is happening in front of your very eyes. If I dry, or if I make a mistake, or if I, we talked earlier when we just first met, Nicola, about doing Dark Road.
Yes.
And
Ian Rankin's play.
Yes, and you and I were in it, and often found ourselves in the central part of the revolve, which changed the set round. And I was always doing a quick change in there. And there was one never to be forgotten night when I was standing there, and I was down to my bra and knickers, and I was getting into whatever outfit it was, and Joe, who was the wardrobe assistant at the time, suddenly yanked me by the hair and pulled me back into the thing and sort of threw me to the ground. And I was like, how dare you, you bitch, blah, 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 blah. And she went, no, look. And I had, the set hadn't closed properly, and my Marks and Spencer's knickered covered bottom was in full view of the audience.
I will never forget that morning, because the door had swung open on the set, and I remember that the daggers you gave Joe, because you didn't understand what was going on. And myself and Jonathan were tucked up this ridiculous tiny little corridor within the set, trying not to fall out as it turned. And I remember you're like, well, thank goodness I had my Marks and Spencer's pants on, because you had just flashed the audience.
That was it. So just so live before your very eyes, you know. Were you there the night that Maureen Beattie flashed her knickers? Yes, I was. So what I'm trying to say is, don't be frightened, because it is live, and it's charged, and it's you, the audience, sit there, are seeing that, and you do not know what's going to happen this night. Anything could happen. So that's the readiness is all, respect for your fellow performers, don't be afraid, stick up for yourself.
That's a good one.
If somebody says, in very simple terms, if the designer says, I'm going to put you in my case, in a smock, in a lovely sort of autumnal orange colour, just say no, I'm not going to be in a smock. Number one, I'm not going to be in a smock. And number two, I'm not going to be in a lovely autumnal colour, because I will look as if I've been exhumed. So I'm taking that's up. No, forgive me, all you wonderful designers, because back when I started, designers, you wouldn't challenge anything. You'd no say. Now, of course, what normally happens is designers come to the first read through. They've got some ideas. They show you some stuff, and then you have a chat and you talk about it. What you think as well. And that's. But so stick up for yourself. Stick up for your. You know, if you find it difficult to walk in high heels, just get heels that are lower. Don't give yourself grief. And look after your health, and don't get caught up in too much barring. And all that stuff that goes with it. And we'll just pop round to so-and-so's house and we'll have another couple of jars until 3 o'clock in the morning. What we do takes an enormous amount of physical, mental and spiritual energy. It's massive. People, that's the other thing which drives me nuts, the snowflakes thing, you know, the fluffy bunnies. Our industry are full of courage. And my final point, so I think that's four, would be, don't forget to listen to your fellow performers. Listen to what they're saying. Listen to what the other people are saying, but on stage, listen and try to be in the moment as much as you can, and really hear what that person is giving you that night, because it could subtly change the way that you perform. And don't be frightened when you find that the day after you do your final performance of any play, you suddenly realise the right way to say a line that you've never got right, because that's what happens to everybody, and I've never known it to fail. So don't worry, it always happens.
Thank you, Maureen. They're wonderful. I'm going to follow all of them. Thank you. If I said to you Scottish arts and culture, what comes to mind?
I think the Celticness of it all at its best. The fact that that's very much who we are, is our Celticness deep, deep in our soul, and the reason why we are really good at things like Chekhov, because we're like the Russians. We can literally go within a nanosecond from crying our eyes out in the deepest despair in the world to laughing hysterically about something. And to be proud of that, because when I was at drama school and the early days, you know, I was here at the Lyceum in the 70s for 3 solid years doing all these wonderful things. We never did, unless it was a Scottish play, you didn't do it Scots, you played it in an English accent. So we all played Chekhov English, we played Ibsen English, we played Shakespeare English, we played, you know, you name it, you did it with an English accent.
What is wrong with speaking in your own tongue?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and actually Shakespeare, back in the day when Shakespeare was around, was not done in, you know, RP. No. That's something that has come about over time. I've got to ask you just before we wrap up, obviously I've watched you on TV over the years. I grew up watching you, as I called you, Scottish Sandra in Casualty.
Scottish Sandra.
Scottish Sandra. And you have been in Doctor Who in the Christmas special.
Yes.
Which is incredible. How was that? And do you go to the conventions, Maureen?
Do you know, I don't. And I suppose I could, because I've got friends who, you know, Sean Biggerstaff, who played, you'll know Sean, who played Harry Potter's, the captain of Harry Potter's Quidditch team, wonderfully, is, you know, when he's got time off from the old acting, is getting a bit all over the place, going to these things. People just love it. So there's a thought. When I need my windows replaced, I'm going to be starting about that. But it was absolutely fabulous. I mean, I saw the very first episode of Doctor Who ever. I've watched it since the very beginning. That terrible sound of those Daleks, just seeing the very, very first one. Oh my God, it was amazing. And of course, when I did my my episode, the Christmas special, it was our dear Peter Capaldi, who was the Doctor.
Yes.
Absolutely fantastic. It was wonderful. It was everything I wanted it to be. Oh my God, yes, it was fabulous. The characters, the sort of storyline that I had was, I was part of a team that were in a, sort of an Antarctic expedition in this kind of, you know, bubble, you know, doing some research. And we never got into the TARDIS. We never got into that. So we're all at that. So I went up to one of the, you know, the assistant directors and said, any chance of getting into the TARDIS to see it? So there was me at my great age and various... all the other people there, and that would be great. So is it all right? Yeah, opened up that. It's on a completely different, it's on a separate set of its own, of course. And we went, oh my God. So guys like that, would you like me to put the lights on? Oh, so the light, those lights that go down like that, and the thing going, and there was a, would you like the music? Oh my God. Would you like the sound? That's right. So and then we're all running around, literally like, Aegis singing. Absolutely fantastic. And you know, they just are so delightful. They know what they've got. They know that they've got something really precious. Mm. It's such a precious thing, Doctor Who, somehow. The whole ethos behind it, the stories it tells, you know, the morals backbone of it and all that. One of my favourite experiences of my whole career.
Oh, it just sounds wonderful. I mean, yeah, it kind of feels like a child going into a sweetie shop, I imagine.
Exactly, exactly.
So lastly, I am going to move on to the quick fire questions. Maureen. So I do tell people, I tell all guests that these are the fundamentals on which I judge a person. So judged, Miss Beattie. So I will give you two options, and if you could just fire back with your instinctive answer.
Okay.
Here goes. TV or theatre?
Theatre.
The Bard or Burns?
Burns.
Chippy sauce or no chippy sauce?
Oh, no chippy sauce.
Sin or virtue?
Virtue.
Stage left or stage right?
Stage left.
Evening or matinee?
Evening.
The stalls or the royal box?
The stalls.
Quinoa or cake?
Cake.
Yep. Arthur Miller or Molière?
Arthur Miller.
True crime or fiction?
Fiction.
Opera or ballet?
Ballet.
Land or sea?
Sea.
Warm up or fly by the seat?
Warm up.
Period dance or stage fighting?
Period dance.
Fancy Nancy or dress down?
Dress down.
And that concludes the quickfire questions. Thank you so much for coming on, Maureen. I've had an absolute blast talking to you and hearing these wonderful, vibrant stories. Thank you so much.
A huge pleasure. I'm going to tell you one wee story before I leave.
Please do.
Often you get sort of like cake or chocolate or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
And Dawn French always said, there are two kinds of women in the world. Those that love chocolate and bitches.
That's very true.
Very true. It's been a great pleasure.
Well, what a fascinating chat. I just loved having Maureen as one of the Cultural Coven witches. I adore her wealth of knowledge and her hilarious tales. Do check out Maureen's next project, Helping Hands, which premieres as part of Pitlochry Theatre's Soundstage project. It's directed by Elizabeth Newman and runs from the 26th to the 28th of November. Thank you for joining us. If you're enjoying the conversation, please do remember to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And stay in touch with us on Twitter at Cultural Coven or Instagram at Cultural Coven Pod. Next up is one of Edinburgh's finest. It is Scottish broadcaster, DJ, panto star and actor currently seen in BBC Scotland River City. Yes, you guessed it. It's that Edinburgh gadgie, Grant Stott. You're in for a treat. It's bye for now from me, Nicola Roy. I hope you have a good week and take care. The Cultural Coven is presented in association with the Stephen Dunn Theatre Fund and the Lyceum Theatre, is co-created by me, Nicola Roy, and is produced by Lee Kennedy, with editing and sound engineering by Barry McCall and music by Cameron Barnes.